Attention listeners, we're excited to announce that AfterSight will be moving to our new office on March 26th. As we make this transition, our services will be down most of the day. We apologize for any inconvenience, but truly appreciate your understanding as we start this new chapter. Thank you for listening to AfterSight.
Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Good day, Colorado, and thank you for joining us for the March 5th reading of The Environment. My name is John. Today I've got a couple of articles from the Magazine of the Sierra Club. Climate disasters are revealing the vulnerability of U.S. water systems. And following that article, Between Earth and Sky, What Grows Back After Disturbance. Any time remaining, I'll grab an article from the Nature Conservancy or Mother Earth News to share as well. So back to our first article. Climate disasters are revealing the vulnerability of U.S. water systems. Wildfires and hurricanes are the latest examples of extreme weather cutting communities off from this vital resource. Authored by Colleen Haggerty. As wildfires burned across Los Angeles in early January, nearly 200,000 people were put under evacuation orders. In the weeks since, these residents have slowly started returning, some to properties that were lost to the fires, and others to structures that seemed to be untouched, but where less visible threats lurk. That includes potential contaminants coursing through the water pipes beneath their feet, which can incur fire damage that takes days, if not weeks, to address. Within the first 24 hours of the two largest ignitions, the Eaton and Palisades fires, multiple zip codes in LA County were placed under some degree of water warnings, ranging from boil before using to do not use advisories. In Santa Monica, signs on door handles blared in bold red font, "Do not drink the tap water." In Altadena, National Guard members stationed at evacuation zone entry points were equipped with stacks of bottled water to distribute. More than 5 weeks after the fires first sparked, many of those advisories and uncertainties remain. Similar challenges have plagued residents after other destructive wildfires, including the 2018 Camp Fire, the 2021 Marshall Fire, and the 2023 Lahaina Fire, all of which impacted the infrastructure of local water systems. Other climate-related disasters, including hurricanes, floods, and extreme temperatures, can also contaminate or damage water systems. Following Hurricane Helene's devastating impact in Asheville, North Carolina last fall, it took weeks to get water flowing again and nearly 2 months for authorities to deem that water safe to drink. Throughout this time, residents reported coming up against systemic gaps in the response that made the recoveries harder to navigate. Disasters, by nature, tend to disrupt even the best laid plans, particularly as climate change resets the parameters of what we can expect from the next hurricane, wildfire, or heat wave. Experts say there is a need for government officials and utility agencies across the United States to step up their preparations and response to extreme weather events in recognition that they have become more common and are increasingly leaving communities cut off from the water sources they rely on. What we see certainly after wildfires, but also man-made incidents and other natural disasters, is that a bunch of different agencies are kind of winging it, said Andrew Welton, a professor of civil, environmental, and ecological engineering at Purdue University. Murky waters. The Safe Drinking Water Act sets the stage in the United States for public water standards, but when it comes to disasters, there is a lot left up to interpretation, according to Ellen Warren Betanzo, founder and president of the consulting firm Safe Water Engineering, LLC. Betanzo said the Environmental Protection Agency has not set a national standard for defining what constitutes a water emergency or what sort of public notice that necessitates. There are also no federal regulations for testing water sources for any specific chemicals after a disaster, according to Welton. The states get to determine what's acceptable for their populations and what's not, Welton said. We keep seeing the same issues where people that are responsible for green lighting and red lighting decisions at state levels are unprepared to make those decisions because they do not have the background. Welton's research and publications on water infrastructure in wildfire-impacted communities in California, Hawaii, and Colorado have made him a go-to source for water utilities, government officials, and residents who often don't know where else to turn following disasters. While the EPA does offer suggestions for putting together emergency plans and exercises, Betanzo said the capacity to carry out this work is contingent on how well-resourced local governments and water utilities are, which can be quite varied. Depending on where you live, you might be part of a water system serving millions or as few as 25 people, or you might have your own private well system. In each of these cases, there are significantly different options available for responding to a large-scale disruptive event. Different disasters also give rise to different vulnerabilities. Fast-moving events, such as wildfires or storms, might damage the basic infrastructure by melting or breaking the components involved in moving water, including the municipal pipes that carry potable water from treatment plants. These disasters also often cause power outages that depressurize water systems. This makes the system more vulnerable to sucking in outside contaminants, such as debris or fire smoke, which can then mix with water or even leach into the pipes. Contaminated water then flows through the system when it repressurizes, including into homes. Longer-term or slower disasters, such as heat or drought conditions, also cause wear and tear, potentially degrading plastic pipes over time or causing cracks that can let contaminants into the drinking water. And flooding can cause sewers to back up, creating a distinctly different but still dangerous situation. Adding to this already lengthy list of variables are the different types of contaminants that might make it into these systems, depending on which of the above destruction boxes are ticked. The contaminants at play can include bacteria, such as E. coli, and chemicals from common household items that can be toxic if ingested, such as paint, cleaning supplies, and pesticides. In the case of wildfires, smoke and ash might also make their way into water systems. Each contaminant requires a distinct response, from the way utilities treat the issue to how it is communicated to the public. Betanzo identified public outreach as an often overlooked but incredibly important part of post-disaster planning after researching the effects of 2017's Hurricane Maria on Puerto Rico's water system. This messaging is another area where she said guidelines tend to be vague, making it difficult to know who is supposed to issue warnings and on what timeline. Welton saw this issue after wildfires as well. Following the 2023 Lahaina wildfire, Welton wrote that all the homeowners he spoke with used potentially contaminated water before they learned their area was under an unsafe water advisory. In many cases, Welton has found that disaster survivors often have to step up and demand testing and transparency after disasters or even make their own contingency plans. Filling the gaps. After Hurricane Helene, the city of Asheville set up a dedicated water service recovery website where officials continue to share regular updates and post links to press conferences. As in Los Angeles, officials also distributed bottled water. But in the early weeks following the storm, residents in the region quickly realized the lack of electricity and accessible water was creating a public health issue that none of these plans addressed. With no electricity and no running water, people did not just need water to drink, bathe, cook, and clean. They needed it to flush their toilets. "We have a composting toilet," said Molly Black, one such resident, carefully choosing her words. "But, you know, our neighbors did not have those capacities." Black was not the only resident who realized this was an issue, particularly in areas that were further from water sources. Even those who live near a body of water, like a river or pond, might not have had the physical ability to haul filled buckets back and forth repeatedly as needed. So she connected with other volunteers in the area and co-founded a grassroots group called Flush AVL. Together, they gathered 410 totes, or large plastic water containers, and set up a request system to identify areas that could use them. The need was significant enough that a second volunteer-run effort, beloved Asheville's Flush Brigade, also began coordinating services to address this brewing public health crisis. In some cases, volunteers physically carried buckets of water into homes and apartments to take care of the flushing. In others, they set them up and taught residents how to use them. Dan Bright, a volunteer with Plenty International who worked with Black, said the volunteers ultimately ended up collaborating with local and federal officials who helped with tasks such as filling totes for distribution, recognizing the significant need volunteers were filling. I add that to the story not to detract from the city or the county or anybody else, Bright clarified. This was a highly fluid and unknown situation that nobody had plans intact for. It ultimately took 53 days for Asheville's water infrastructure to be fixed, a process that included repairing damaged water lines and flushing out the system to get rid of contaminants that entered through those breaks or due to the loss of pressure. 5 weeks out from the fires in Los Angeles, residents are facing a similar waiting game, preventing the next water disaster. Welton said the good news is that we have the science and know-how now to both identify and address disaster impacts when they occur or even to prevent extreme events from being as disruptive. He recently co-authored a guidance document for public water system staffers, which included strategies and contributions from communities who have experienced wildfire water issues firsthand. For example, after the 2018 Camp Fire, the city of Paradise, California, installed backflow prevention devices on their service line, which are the pipes that connect buildings to the water main line that is directly linked to the water source. Installing these devices ensures water only flows from the source forward through the pipes, preventing the backflow of water in the opposite direction, the situation that sucks in contaminants when power outages depressurize water systems. In the wake of the 2021 Marshall Fire, the city of Louisville, Colorado, has moved to install automatic shutoffs for its service lines so that employees will not have to put themselves at physical risk during future fires. Establishing a backup power source is another popular mitigation tactic, as a lack of electricity can be another source of depressurization. Betanzo warned that considering ways to disaster prep water systems is just part of a larger conversation communities need to be having about accountability in the time of climate change. It's not just making sure there are plans and contingencies, but identifying some of the structural questions underpinning those issues, like whether water systems can support continued development in an area. Otherwise, communities are going to continue to find themselves not only facing situations they have not planned for, but also potentially facing complications that do not have an easy fix. If we're not designing for what we know is coming, we are never going to get ahead of this, she said. It is just fundamentally making sure that we have standards that are appropriate for the climate we live in and the climate change that we know is coming. The second article we'll share today comes also from the Magazine of the Sierra Club and is titled, Between Earth and Sky, What Grows Back After a Disturbance? A new film explores the resilience and hopes Nalini Nadkarni found in her work studying tree canopies. Written by Kitty Hugh. Renowned forest ecologist Nalini Nadkarni's favorite tree is a strangler fig named Figuerola in Monteverde, Costa Rica. Nestled within the lush rainforest ecosystem, Figuerola is over 200 feet tall and has wide branches that stretch horizontally as far as the eye can see. Each time I go up, it's this sense of newness, of seeing the world in a different way, Nadkarni remarks. Nicknamed the Queen of the Forest Canopy, Nadkarni pioneered an innovative climbing technique using a master caster, her own invention, essentially a metal rod with a slingshot attached to one side and a fishing reel on the other. With this tool, Nadkarni has climbed hundreds of trees across the United States, Costa Rica, New Zealand, and Papua New Guinea, and has published research in more than 120 articles. She inspired the Treetop Barbie, presented at several TED Talks, and was even featured in a Playboy magazine series highlighting the work of professors. Now, she's the focus of an Academy Award shortlisted documentary film, Between Earth and Sky. directed and produced by her nephew, Andrew Ned Carney, the film profiles the elder Ned Carney returning to her roots, literally and figuratively. Gently holding a picture of a younger self, she says in the film, "I wish she knew that people loved her, because I think she did not know that." As a daughter of Indian and Russian parents, growing up in a Hindu-Jewish household, Ned Carney was taught to be quiet, listen to her elders, and keep secrets. She navigated a difficult childhood and always felt like she had to accomplish more in order to be recognized or loved. There are these deep disturbances that happen to people throughout their lives, starting maybe when they're 8 years old. The trees were there as my witness. She turned to climbing maple trees as a child after school to escape. Sometimes she'd bring a book. Other times she'd create imaginary worlds, pretending the treetop was a refuge for wounded birds. They were dependable. You could trust them. They did not have any harsh words to say, and they did not have any expectations. As she grew older, this early refuge became a deep source of wonder and knowledge. In the 1980s, when she was a young ecologist, she was told to focus on the forest floor, but she felt called to the canopy. In the rainforest of Olympic National Park in Washington, she peeled away mats of moss and underlying canopy soils to find a network of canopy root systems. Sitting high above the ground, Ned Carney discovered that in the forest canopy, epiphytes such as orchids and ferns were trapping organic-rich material and developing aerial roots, allowing trees to access nourishment outside of the nutrient-poor soil. These root systems help trees retain nourishment and water from the very mosses and soil that they themselves support. In a For the Wild podcast episode with host Ayanna Young, Ned Carney says, "Sometimes when I arrive to the top of the tree, and if you were sitting next to me, I might have a conversation more about spirituality than about biology. Getting and living and thinking about the tree canopy is really all about connections, which is something I think that all of us feel when we walk beneath the crowns of redwood forest or lowland tropical forest or any sort of forest. Especially in an area of overlapping social and climate crises, Between Earth and Sky offers a timely reminder of the healing, reciprocal relationship we humans have with nature and the resilience of our ecosystems and humanity." In a PBS interview, director Andrew reiterates this sentiment from his experience on set. "Nalini's energetic love for trees is infectious. Spending time with her has made me more attuned, for example, to how a tree's body language shows the scars of injuries weathered in its life." Ned Carney herself carries one such injury. In a visceral montage of abundant forest intercut with x-rays and archival footage, she falls 50 feet to the forest floor while on a routine climb with her graduate students in Olympia, Washington. She cracked 5 vertebrae, broke 9 ribs, lacerated her lung, injured her pelvis in several areas, and broke her fibula. She spent 2 months in the hospital recovering. "I found it interesting to consider how her relationship to trees changed over time," director Ned Carney told PBS. "Trees were safety and refuge to her as a child, a place of exploration and achievement as she climbed high in her career, and a source of danger when she fell. That fall, however, allowed for a new sort of relationship, integrating all that came before into something new." How do you heal while holding histories and experiences of loss and trauma? For Ned Carney, she looked to the trees. "As soon as I fell, I was barraged with expressions of horror, pity, and sympathy for being in my critically injured state," she stated in an article for the University of Utah. "Disturbances, personal injury, forest fires, traffic jams, catastrophic flooding, uprooting of refugees, are often viewed as negative and destructive. Yet, even using the example of fire as something that is needed in nature, Ned Carney wrote, "Fire-adapted tree species require fire to open their serotonous cones, which allow them to grow rapidly using the high light levels and the flush of nutrients that becomes available immediately after a fire. These disturbances, personal and ecological, present us with an opportunity to sit with difficult reflections while finding new versions of ourselves and our world through this exploration. It is actually very rare for any system, after a disturbance, to revert to its former state," Ned Carney says in the film. It doesn't happen in nature. It doesn't happen in human lives. Toward the end of the film, we see Ned Carney return to her favorite strangler fig, Figuerola, in Costa Rica for a research trip. Looking down at the camera through layers of leaves and epiphytes, she shares, "I feel I'm back home again. I thought I'd be a lot more scared, but I'm not. Maybe because it's Figuerola." Between Earth and Sky, screened globally at Big Sky Doc Fest, DC Environmental Film Fest, Doc New York City, Sheffield Doc Fest, Hot Docs, and other festivals. It premiered in season 6 of the critically acclaimed PBS series POV Shorts and is available to watch online. So long as we're reading about trees, I've got another article right behind this one in the magazine of the Sierra Club. Even trees need friends. A study finds trees' ability to migrate as the climate warms could depend on beneficial fungi. Written by Nathan Gillies. Climate change has not been good for the world's trees. Scientists have linked human-caused climate change to die-offs of eucalyptus trees in Australia, beech trees in Germany, and pines in the American West. Many of them believe these die-offs occur because climates are changing faster than trees can adapt. Climate, specifically temperature and precipitation, largely determines where trees and other plants can grow. The problem is that plant-growing ranges are expected to move with the changing climate. In the northern hemisphere, tree-growing ranges are predicted to shift northward in latitude and upward in elevation. As this happens, trees are expected to be out of sync with their environments. As the cooler, wetter conditions they initially grew in, adapted to, and evolved in shift, trees could become climate refugees stranded in a hotter, drier world. In fact, these range shifts are likely already happening, which, according to some, can be seen in the current wave of tree die-offs. But what if climate wasn't the whole story? This question is now being asked by a growing number of researchers who have begun challenging the long-held assumption that climate alone will guide plant migrations. As proof, they argue, one need only look in the soil. According to one of these contrarian studies published last summer in the journal Ecological Monographs, one group of soil-dwelling organisms known to help trees could make or break their successful migration: beneficial mycorrhizal fungi. Mycorrhizal fungi are symbiotic organisms that use trees and other plants as hosts. While some mycorrhizal fungi are parasitic, many are mutualists that benefit their hosts. This includes providing their host trees with nitrogen, phosphorus, and other nutrients. Mycorrhizal fungi can also protect their tree partners from heavy metals in the soil and disease-causing agents, including other fungi. Some scientists believe that these fungi and the vast underground networks they create help trees exchange nutrients with one another, an underground community known as the Wood Wide Web. In exchange for these services, trees provide their fungal collaborators with food in the form of sugars produced via photosynthesis, something the fungi, being more akin to animals than plants, cannot do. Given the importance of mycorrhizal fungi to trees, the study asks the question, can trees migrate without their mycorrhizal partners? The answer, researchers have found, is probably no. The study focused on two northeastern North American tree species, American beech and sugar maple, and the mycorrhizal fungi they partner with, Ectomycorrhiza for beech and Arbuscular mycorrhiza for maples. Both tree species are common at lower elevations throughout the eastern United States, but their ranges are expected to migrate upward in elevation to sites now dominated by conifers, which are expected to become climatically out of sync with these sites in the decades ahead. What's more, many of these sites already have climates conducive to beeches and maples. But, according to the study, only the American beech is likely to be a successful migrant because the soil at these higher elevation sites contains sufficient amounts of the ectomycorrhiza, which the trees use. The outlook for sugar maples, however, is less optimistic due to lower levels of their companion fungi, Arbuscular mycorrhiza, in the same soil. Climate is definitely important for plant growth, and soil chemistry as well. Jordan Tourville, the study's lead author, said, but the fact that mycorrhizal fungi had an effect independent of those things, and a significant effect at that, was quite striking. Tourville, who is a staff scientist at the Appalachian Mountain Club based in Boston, conducted the study over a three-year period while completing his PhD at the State University of New York. The experiments revealed that seedlings grown with the tree's companion mycorrhizal fungi had higher survival rates than seedlings grown without them. The researchers observed this trend in both greenhouse-raised seedlings and seedlings grown at upslope migration sites. What all this means, the study concludes, is that although new areas might become climatically suitable for trees as the climate warms, seedlings are unlikely to establish themselves if their suitable fungal partners are not present. This finding, Tourville said, complicates efforts to predict when and where trees will likely migrate as the climate warms, because most predictions are based on scientific models that use only climate. Tourville concluded, I think the implication of this study is mycorrhizal fungi are super important. There's a lot more to plant migration than just temperature and moisture. That takes up all the time we have today. Thank you so much for joining us for the March 5th reading of The Environment. My name is John.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.